They left it at that. The next day, Clemenza spoke with Fanucci to make sure that Vito was not making up the story. Then Clemenza came to Vito's apartment and gave him the $200. He peered at Vito Corleone and said, "Fanucci told me nothing below $300. How will you make him take less?" Vito Corleone said reasonably, "Surely that's no concern of yours. Just remember that I have done you a service." Tessio came later. Tessio was more reserved than Clemenza, sharper, more clever, but with less force. He sensed something amiss, something not quite right. He was a little worried. He said to Vito Corleone, "Watch yourself with that bastard of a Black Hand. He's tricky as a priest. Do you want me to be here when you hand him the money as a witness?" Vito Corleone shook his head. He didn't even bother to answer. He merely said to Tessio, "Tell Fanucci I'll pay him the money here in my house at 9 o'clock tonight. I'll have to give him a glass of wine and talk, reason with him to take the lesser sum." Tessio shook his head. "You won't have much luck. Fanucci never retreats." "I'll reason with him," Vito Corleone said. It was to become a famous phrase in the years to come. It was to become the warning rattle before a deadly strike. When he became a don and asked opponents to sit down and reason with him, they understood it was the last chance to resolve an affair without bloodshed and murder. Vito Corleone told his wife to take the two children, Sonny and Fredo, down into the street after supper and on no account to let them come up to the house until he gave her permission. She was to sit on guard at the tenement door. He had some private business with Fanucci that could not be interrupted. He saw the look of fear on her face and was angry. He said to her quietly, "Do you think you've married a fool?" She didn't answer. She did not answer because she was frightened, not of Fanucci now, but of her husband. He was changing visibly before her eyes, hour by hour, into a man who radiated some dangerous force. He had always been quiet, speaking little, but always gentle, always reasonable, which was extraordinary in a young Sicilian male. What she was seeing was the shedding of his protective coloration of a harmless nobody now that he was ready to start on his destiny. He had started late. He was 25 years old, but he was to start with a flourish. Vito Corleone had decided to murder Fanucci. By doing so, he would have an extra $700 in his bankroll, the $300 he himself would have to pay the Black Hand terrorist, and the $200 from Tessio and the $200 from Clemenza. If he did not kill Fanucci, he would have to pay the man $700 cold cash. Fanucci alive was not worth $700 to him. He would not pay $700 to keep Fanucci alive. If Fanucci needed $700 for an operation to save his life, he would not give Fanucci $700 for the surgeon. He owed Fanucci no personal debt of gratitude. They were not blood relatives. He did not love Fanucci. Why, then, should he give Fanucci $700? And it followed, inevitably, that since Fanucci wished to take $700 from him by force, why should he not kill Fanucci? Surely, the world could do without such a person. There were, of course, some practical reasons. Fanucci might indeed have powerful friends who would seek vengeance. Fanucci himself was a dangerous man, not so easily killed. There were the police and the electric chair. But Vito Corleone had lived under a sentence of death since the murder of his father. As a boy of 12, he had fled his executioners and crossed the ocean into a strange land, taking a strange name. And years of quiet observation had convinced him that he had more intelligence and more courage than other men, though he had never had the opportunity to use that intelligence and courage. And yet he hesitated before taking the first step toward his destiny. He even packed the $700 in a single fold of bills and put the money in a convenient side pocket of his trousers. But he put the money in the left side of his trousers. In the right-hand pocket, he put the gun Clemenza had given him to use in the hijacking of the silk truck. Fanucci came promptly at 9 in the evening. Vito Corleone set out a jug of homemade wine that Clemenza had given him. Fanucci put his white fedora on the table beside the jug of wine. He loosened his broad, multi-flowered tie, its tomato stains camouflaged by the bright patterns. The summer night was hot, the gaslight feeble. It was very quiet in the apartment. But Vito Corleone was icy. To show his good faith, he handed over the roll of bills and watched carefully as Fanucci, after counting it, took out a wide leather wallet and stuffed the money inside. Fanucci sipped his glass of wine and said, "You still owe me $200. His heavy-browed face was expressionless. Vito Corleone said in his cool, reasonable voice, "I'm a little short. I've been out of work. Let me owe you the money for a few weeks." This was a permissible gambit. Fanucci had the bulk of the money and would wait. He might even be persuaded to take nothing more or to wait a little longer. He chuckled over his wine and said, "Ah, you're a sharp young fellow. How is it I've never noticed you before? You're too quiet a chap for your own interest. I could find some work for you to do that would be very profitable." Vito Corleone showed his interest with a polite nod and filled up the man's glass from the purple jug. But Fanucci thought better of what he was going to say and rose from his chair and shook Vito's hand. "Good night, young fellow," he said. "No hard feelings, eh? If I can ever do you a service, let me know. You've done a good job for yourself tonight." Vito let Fanucci go down the stairs and out the building. The street was thronged with witnesses to show that he had left the Corleone home safely. Vito watched from the window. He saw Fanucci turn the corner toward 11th Avenue and knew he was headed toward his apartment, probably to put away his loot before coming out on the streets again. Perhaps to put away his gun. Vito Corleone left his apartment and ran up the stairs to the roof. He traveled over the square block of roofs and descended down the steps of an empty loft building fire escape that left him in the backyard. He kicked the back door open and went through the front door. Across the street was Fanucci's tenement apartment house. The village of tenements extended only as far west as 10th Avenue. 11th Avenue was mostly warehouses and lofts rented by firms who shipped by New York Central Railroad and wanted access to the freight yards that honeycombed the area from 11th Avenue to the Hudson River. Fanucci's apartment house was one of the few left standing in this wilderness and was occupied mostly by bachelor trainmen, yard workers, and the cheapest prostitutes. These people did not sit in the street and gossip like honest Italians. They sat in beer taverns, guzzling their pay. So Vito Corleone found it an easy matter to slip across the deserted 11th Avenue and into the vestibule of Fanucci's apartment house. There he drew the gun he had never fired and waited for Fanucci. He watched through the glass door of the vestibule, knowing Fanucci would come down from 10th Avenue. Clemenza had showed him the safety on the gun, and he had triggered it empty. But as a young boy in Sicily at the early age of 9, he had often gone hunting with his father, had often fired the heavy shotgun called the Lupara. It was his skill with the Lupara, even as a small boy, that had brought the sentence of death upon him by his father's murderers. Now waiting in the darkened hallway, he saw the white blob of Fanucci crossing the street toward the doorway. Vito stepped back, shoulders pressed against the inner door that led to the stairs. He held his gun out to fire. His extended hand was only 2 paces from the outside door. The door swung in. Fanucci, white, broad, smelly, filled the square of light. Vito Corleone fired. The open door let some of the sound escape into the street. The rest of the gun's explosion shook the building. Fanucci was holding on to the sides of the door, trying to stand erect, trying to reach for his gun. The force of his struggle had torn the buttons off his jacket and made it swing loose. His gun was exposed, but so was a spidery vein of red on the white shirt front of his stomach. Very carefully, as if he were plunging a needle into a vein, Vito Corleone fired his second bullet into that red web. Fanucci fell to his knees, propping the door open. He let out a terrible groan, the groan of a man in great physical distress that was almost comical. He kept giving these groans. Vito remembered hearing at least three of them before he put the gun against Fanucci's sweaty, suety cheek and fired into his brain. No more than 5 seconds had passed when Fanucci slumped into death, jamming the door open with his body. Very carefully, Vito took the wide wallet out of the dead man's jacket pocket and put it inside his shirt. Then he walked across the street into the loft building, through that into the yard, and climbed the fire escape to the roof. From there, he surveyed the street. Fanucci's body was still lying in the doorway, but there was no sign of any other person. Two windows had gone up in the tenement, and he could see dark heads poked out, but since he could not see their features, they had certainly not seen his. And such men would not give information to the police. Fanucci might lie there until dawn, or until a patrolman making the rounds stumbled on his body. No person in that house would deliberately expose himself to police suspicion or questioning. They would lock their doors and pretend they had heard nothing. He could take his time. He traveled over the rooftops to his own roof door and down to his own flat. He unlocked the door, went inside, and then locked the door behind him. He rifled the dead man's wallet. Besides the $700 he had given Fanucci, there were only some singles and a $5 note. Tucked inside the flap was an old $5 gold piece, probably a luck token. If Fanucci was a rich gangster, he certainly did not carry his wealth with him. This confirmed some of Vito's suspicions. He knew he had to get rid of the wallet and the gun, knowing enough even then that he must leave the gold piece in the wallet. He went up on the roof again and traveled over a few ledges. He threw the wallet down one air shaft, then he emptied the gun of bullets and smashed its barrel against the roof ledge. The barrel wouldn't break. He reversed it in his hand and smashed the butt against the side of a chimney. The butt split into two halves. He smashed it again and the pistol broke into barrel and handle, two separate pieces. He used a separate air shaft for each. They made no sound when they struck the earth 5 stories below, but sank into the soft hill of garbage that had accumulated there. In the morning, more garbage would be thrown out of the windows and, with luck, would cover everything. Vito returned to his apartment. He was trembling a little, but was absolutely under control. He changed his clothes, and fearful that some blood might have splattered on them, he threw them into a metal tub his wife used for washing. He took lye and heavy brown laundry soap to soak the clothes and scrub them with the metal washboard beneath the sink. Then he scoured tub and sink with lye and soap. He found a bundle of newly washed clothes in the corner of the bedroom and mingled his own clothes with these. Then he put on a fresh shirt and trousers and went down to join his wife and children and neighbors in front of the tenement. All these precautions proved to be unnecessary. The police, after discovering the dead body at dawn, never questioned Vito Corleone. Indeed, he was astonished that they never learned about Fanucci's visit to his home on the night he was shot to death. He had counted on that for an alibi, Fanucci leaving the tenement alive. He only learned later that the police had been delighted with the murder of Fanucci and not too anxious to pursue his killers. They had assumed it was another gang execution and had questioned hoodlums with records in the rackets and a history of strong arm. Since Vito had never been in trouble, he never came into the picture. But if he had outwitted the police, his partners were another matter. Pete Clemenza and Tessio avoided him for the next week, for the next 2 weeks. Then they came to call on him one evening. They came with obvious respect. Vito Corleone greeted them with impassive courtesy and served them wine. Clemenza spoke first. He said softly, Nobody is collecting from the store owners on 9th Avenue. Nobody is collecting from the card games and gambling in the neighborhood. Vito Corleone gazed at both men steadily, but did not reply. Tessio spoke. We could take over Fanucci's customers. They would pay us. Vito Corleone shrugged. Why come to me? I have no interest in such things. Clemenza laughed. Even in his youth, before growing his enormous belly, he had a fat man's laugh. He said now to Vito Corleone, How about that gun I gave you for the truck job? Since you won't need it anymore, you can give it back to me. Very slowly and deliberately, Vito Corleone took a wad of bills out of his side pocket and peeled off 5 tens. Here, I'll pay you. I threw the gun away after the truck job. He smiled at the two men. At that time, Vito Corleone did not know the effect of this smile. It was chilling because it attempted no menace. He smiled as if it was some private joke only he himself could appreciate. But since he smiled in that fashion only in affairs that were lethal, and since the joke was not really private, and since his eyes did not smile, and since his outward character was usually so reasonable and quiet, the sudden unmasking of his true self was frightening. Clemenza shook his head. I don't want the money, he said. Vito pocketed the bills. He waited. They all understood each other. They knew he had killed Fanucci, and though they never spoke about it to anyone, the whole neighborhood, within a few weeks, also knew. Vito Corleone was treated as a man of respect by everyone. But he made no attempt to take over the Fanucci rackets and tributes. What followed then was inevitable. One night, Vito's wife brought a neighbor, a widow, to the flat. The woman was Italian and of unimpeachable character. She worked hard to keep a home for her fatherless children. Her 16-year-old son brought home his pay envelope sealed to hand over to her in the old country style. Her 17-year-old daughter, a dressmaker, did the same. The whole family sewed buttons on cards at night at slave labor piece rates. The woman's name was Signora Colombo. Vito Corleone's wife said, The Signora has a favor to ask of you. She is having some trouble. Vito Corleone expected to be asked for money, which he was ready to give. But it seemed that Mrs. Colombo owned a dog, which her youngest son adored. The landlord had received complaints on the dog barking at night and had told Mrs. Colombo to get rid of it. She pretended to do so. The landlord had found out that she had deceived him and had ordered her to vacate her apartment. She had promised this time to truly get rid of the dog, and she had done so. But the landlord was so angry that he would not revoke his order. She had to get out, or the police would be summoned to put her out. And her poor little boy had cried so when they had given the dog away to relatives who lived in Long Island. All for nothing. They would lose their home. Vito Corleone asked her gently, Why do you ask me to help you? Mrs. Colombo nodded toward his wife. She told me to ask you. He was surprised. His wife had never questioned him about the clothes he had washed the night he had murdered Fanucci, had never asked him where all the money came from when he was not working. Even now her face was impassive. Vito said to Mrs. Colombo, I can give you some money to help you move. Is that what you want? The woman shook her head. She was in tears.
All of my friends are here. All of the girls I grew up with in Italy. How can I move to another neighborhood with strangers? I want you to speak to the landlord to let me stay.
Vito nodded.
It's done, then. You won't have to move. I'll speak to him tomorrow morning.
His wife gave him a smile which he did not acknowledge, but he felt pleased. Mrs. Colombo looked a little uncertain.
You're sure he'll say yes, the landlord? She asked.
Signor Roberto? Vito said in a surprised voice. Of course he will. He's a good-hearted fellow. Once I explain how things are with you, he'll take pity on your misfortunes. Now don't let it trouble you any more. Don't get so upset. Guard your health, for the sake of your children."
The landlord, Mr. Roberto, came to the neighborhood every day to check on the row of 5 tenements that he owned. He was a padrone, a man who sold Italian laborers just off the boat to the big corporations. With his profits, he had bought the tenements one by one. An educated man from the north of Italy, he felt only contempt for these illiterate southerners from Sicily and Naples, who swarmed like vermin through his buildings, who threw garbage down the air shafts, who let cockroaches and rats eat away his walls without lifting a hand to preserve his property. He was not a bad man. He was a good husband and father, but constant worry about his investments, about the money he earned, about the inevitable expenses that came with being a man of property, had worn his nerves to a frazzle so that he was in a constant state of irritation. When Vito Corleone stopped him on the street to ask for a word, Mr. Roberto was brusque. Not rude, since any one of these southerners might stick a knife into you if rubbed the wrong way, though this young man looked like a quiet fellow.
"Señor Roberto," said Vito Corleone, "the friend of my wife, a poor widow with no man to protect her, tells me that for some reason she has been ordered to move from her apartment in your building. She is in despair. She has no money, she has no friends except those that live here. I told her that I would speak to you, that you are a reasonable man who acted out of some misunderstanding. She has gotten rid of the animal that caused all the trouble, and so why shouldn't she stay? As one Italian to another, I ask you the favor."
Señor Roberto studied the young man in front of him. He saw a man of medium stature but strongly built, a peasant but not a bandit, though he so laughably dared to call himself an Italian. Roberto shrugged. "I have already rented the apartment to another family for higher rent," he said. "I cannot disappoint them for the sake of your friend."
Vito Corleone nodded in agreeable understanding. "How much more a month?" he asked.
$5, Mr. Roberto said. This was a lie. The railway flat, 4 dark rooms, rented for $12 a month to the widow, and he had not been able to get more than that from the new tenant. Vito Corleone took a roll of bills out of his pocket and peeled off 3 tens.
"Here is the 6 months' increase in advance. You needn't speak to her about it. She's a proud woman. See me again in another 6 months. But, of course, you'll let her keep her dog."
"Like a hell," Mr. Roberto said. "And who the hell are you to give me orders? Watch your manners or you'll be out on your Sicilian ass in the street there."
Vito Corleone raised his hands in surprise.
"I'm asking you a favor, only that. One never knows when one might need a friend, isn't that true? Here, take this money as a sign of my goodwill and make your own decision. I wouldn't dare to quarrel with it."
He thrust the money into Mr. Roberto's hand.
"Do me this little favor. Just take the money and think things over. Tomorrow morning, if you want to give me the money back, by all means do so. If you want the woman out of your house, how can I stop you? It's your property, after all. If you don't want the dog in there, I can understand. I dislike animals myself."
He patted Mr. Roberto on the shoulder.
"Do me this service, huh? I won't forget it. Ask your friends in the neighborhood about me. They'll tell you I'm a man who believes in showing his gratitude."
But of course, Mr. Roberto had already begun to understand. That evening he made inquiries about Vito Corleone. He did not wait until the next morning. He knocked on the Corleone door that very night, apologizing for the lateness of the hour, and accepted a glass of wine from Signora Corleone. He assured Vito Corleone that it had all been a dreadful misunderstanding, that of course Signora Colombo could remain in the flat, and of course she could keep her dog. Who were those miserable tenants to complain about noise from a poor animal when they paid such a low rent? At the finish, He threw the $30 Vito Corleone had given him on the table and said in the most sincere fashion, "Your good heart in helping this poor widow has shamed me, and I wish to show that I, too, have some Christian charity. Her rent will remain what it was."